When a sanitation crew arrives at a meatpacking plant, usually around midnight, it faces a mess of monumental proportions. 3,000 to 4,000 cattle, each weighing about 1,000 pounds, have been slaughtered there that day. The place has to be clean by sunrise. Some of the workers wear water-resistant clothing, most don't. Their principal cleaning tool is a high-pressure hose that shoots a mixture of water and chlorine heated to about 180 degrees. As the water is sprayed, the plant fills with a thick, heavy fog. Visibility drops to as little as 5 feet. The conveyor belts and machinery are running. Workers stand on the belts, spraying them, riding them like moving sidewalks, as high as 15 feet off the ground. Workers climb ladders with hoses and spray the catwalks. They get under tables and conveyor belts, climbing right into the bloody muck, cleaning out grease, fat, manure, leftover scraps of meat. Glasses and safety goggles fog up. The inside of the plant heats up. Temperatures soon exceed 100 degrees. It's hot and it's foggy and you can't see anything, a former sanitation worker said. The crew members can't see or hear each other when the machinery's running. They routinely spray each other with burning hot, chemical-laden water. They are sickened by the fumes. Jesus, a soft-spoken employee of DCS Sanitation Management Incorporated, the company that IBP uses in many of its plants, told me that every night on the job, he gets terrible headaches. You feel it in your head, he said. You feel it in your stomach, like you want to throw up. One night while Jesus was cleaning, a co-worker forgot to turn off a machine, lost 2 fingers, and went into shock. An ambulance came and took him away, as everyone else continued to clean. He was back at work the following week. If one hand is no good, the supervisor told him, use the other. Another sanitation worker lost an arm in a machine. Now he folds towels in the locker room. The scariest job, according to Jesus, is cleaning the vents on the roof of the slaughterhouse. The vents become clogged with grease and dried blood. In the winter, when everything gets icy and the winds pick up, Jesus worries that a sudden gust will blow him off the roof into the darkness. Although official statistics are not kept, the death rate among slaughterhouse sanitation crews is extraordinarily high. They are the ultimate in disposable workers, illegal, illiterate, impoverished, untrained. The nation's worst job can end in just about the worst way. Sometimes these workers are literally ground up and reduced to nothing. During the same years when the working conditions at America's meatpacking plants became more dangerous, when line speeds increased and illegal immigrants replaced skilled workers, the federal government greatly reduced the enforcement of health and safety laws. OSHA had long been despised by the nation's manufacturers, who considered the agency a source of meddlesome regulations and unnecessary red tape. When Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980, OSHA was already underfunded and understaffed. Its 1,300 inspectors were responsible for the safety of more than 5 million workplaces across the country. A typical American employer could expect an OSHA inspection about once every 80 years. Nevertheless, the Reagan administration was determined to reduce OSHA's authority even further as part of the push for deregulation. The number of OSHA inspectors was eventually cut by 20%, and in 1981, the agency adopted a new policy of voluntary compliance. Instead of arriving unannounced at a factory and performing an inspection, OSHA employees were required to look at a company's injury log before setting foot inside the plant. If the record showed an injury rate at the factory lower than the national average for all manufacturers, the OSHA inspector had to turn around and leave at once, without entering the plant, examining its equipment, or talking to any of its workers. These injury logs were kept and maintained by company officials. OSHA's voluntary compliance policy did indeed reduce the number of recorded injuries in meatpacking plants. It did not, however, reduce the number of people getting hurt. It merely encouraged companies, in the words of a subsequent congressional investigation, to understate injuries, to falsify records, and to cover up accidents. At the IBPBB plant in Dakota City, Nebraska, for example, the company kept two sets of injury logs, one of them recording every injury and illness at the slaughterhouse, the other provided to visiting OSHA inspectors and researchers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. During a three-month period in 1985, the first log recorded 1,800 injuries and illnesses at the plant. The OSHA log recorded only 160, a discrepancy of more than 1,000%. At congressional hearings on meatpacking in 1987, Robert L. Peterson, the chief executive of IBP, denied under oath that two sets of logs were ever kept and called IBP's safety record the best of the best. Congressional investigators later got hold of both logs and found that the injury rate at its Dakota City plant was as much as one-third higher than the average rate in the meatpacking industry. Congressional investigators also discovered that IBP had altered injury records at its beef plant in Emporia, Kansas. Another leading meatpacking company, John Morrell, was caught lying about injuries at its plant in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. The congressional investigation concluded that these companies had failed to report serious injuries such as fractures, concussions, major cuts, hernias, some requiring hospitalization, surgery, even amputation. Congressman Tom Lantos, whose subcommittee conducted the meatpacking inquiry, called IBP one of the most irresponsible and reckless corporations in America. A Labor Department official called the company's behavior the worst example of underreporting injuries and illnesses to workers ever encountered in OSHA's 16-year history. Nevertheless, Robert L. Peterson was never charged with perjury for his misleading testimony before Congress. Investigators argued that it would be difficult to prove conclusively that Peterson had willfully lied. In 1987, IBP was fined $2.6 million by OSHA for underreporting injuries and later fined an additional $3.1 million for the high rate of cumulative trauma injuries at the Dakota City plant. After the company introduced a new safety program there, the fines were reduced to $975,000, a sum that might have appeared large at the time, yet represented about 1/100th of a percent of IBP's annual revenues. During my trips to meatpacking towns in the High Plains, I met dozens of workers who'd been injured. Each of their stories was different, yet somehow familiar, linked by common elements. The same struggle to receive proper medical care, the same fear of speaking out, the same underlying corporate indifference. We're human beings, more than one person told me, but they treat us like animals. The workers I met wanted their stories to be told. They wanted people to know about what is happening right now. A young woman who'd injured her back and her right hand at the Greeley plant said to me, "I want to get on top of a rooftop and scream my lungs out so that somebody will hear." The voices and faces of these workers are indelibly with me, as is the sight of their hands, the light brown skin crisscrossed with white scars. Although I cannot tell all of their stories, a few need to be mentioned. Like all lives, they can be used as examples or serve as representative types. But ultimately, they are unique, individual, impossible to define or replace, the opposite of how this system has treated them. Raul was born in Zapoteca, Mexico, and did construction work in Anaheim before moving to Colorado. He speaks no English. After hearing a Monfort ad on a Spanish-language radio station, he applied for a job at the Greeley plant. One day, Raul reached into a processing machine to remove a piece of meat. The machine accidentally went on. Raul's arm got stuck, and it took workers 20 minutes to get it out. The machine had to be taken apart. An ambulance brought Raul to the hospital, where a deep gash in his shoulder was sewn shut. A tendon had been severed. After getting stitches and a strong prescription painkiller, He was driven back to the slaughterhouse and put back on the production line. Bandaged, groggy, and in pain, one arm tied in a sling, Raoul spent the rest of the day wiping blood off cardboard boxes with his good hand. Kenny Dobbins was a Monfort employee for almost 16 years. He was born in Keokuk, Iowa, had a tough childhood, and an abusive stepfather, left home at the age of 13, went in and out of various schools, never learned to read, did various odd jobs, and wound up at the Monfort Slaughterhouse in Grand Island, Nebraska. He started working there in 1979, right after the company bought it from Swift. He was 23. He worked in the shipping department at first, hauling boxes that weighed as much as 120 pounds. Kenny could handle it, though. He was a big man, muscular and 6'5", and nothing in his life had ever been easy. One day, Kenny heard someone yell, "Watch out!" then turned around and saw a 90-pound box falling from an upper level of the shipping department. Kenny caught the box with one arm, but the momentum threw him against a conveyor belt, and the metal teeth on the rim of the belt pierced his lower back. The company doctor bandaged Kenny's back and said the pain was just a pulled muscle. Kenny never filed for workers' comp, stayed home for a few days, then returned to work. He had a wife and three children to support. For the next few months, he was in terrible pain. "It hurt so fucking bad you wouldn't believe it," he told me. He saw another doctor, got a second opinion. The new doctor said Kenny had a pair of severely herniated discs. Kenny had back surgery, spent a month in the hospital, got sent to a pain clinic when the operation didn't work. His marriage broke up amid the stress and financial difficulty. 14 months after the injury, Kenny returned to the slaughterhouse. "Give up after back surgery? Not Ken Dobbins," a Monfort newsletter proclaimed. "Ken has learned how to handle the rigors of working in a packing plant and is trying to help others do the same. Thanks, Ken, and keep up the good work." Kenny felt a strong loyalty to Monfort. He could not read, possessed few skills other than his strength, and the company had still given him a job. When Monfort decided to reopen its Greeley plant with a non-union workforce, Kenny volunteered to go there and help. He did not think highly of labor unions. His supervisors told him that unions had been responsible for shutting down meatpacking plants all over the country. When the UFCW tried to organize the Greeley slaughterhouse, Kenny became an active and outspoken member of an anti-union group. At the Grand Island facility, Kenny had been restricted to light duty after his injury, but his supervisor in Greeley said that old restrictions didn't apply in this new job. Soon Kenny was doing tough physical labor once again, wielding a knife and grabbing 40 to 50 pound pieces of beef off a table. When the pain became unbearable, he was transferred to ground beef, then to rendering. According to a former manager at the Greeley plant, Monfort was trying to get rid of Kenny, trying to make his work so unpleasant that he'd quit. Kenny didn't realize it. "He still believes in his heart that people are honest and good," the former manager said about Kenny, "and he's wrong." As part of the job in rendering, Kenny sometimes had to climb into gigantic blood tanks and gut bins, reach to the bottom of them with his long arms, and unclog the drains. One day he was unexpectedly called to work over the weekend. There had been a problem with salmonella contamination. The plant needed to be disinfected, and some of the maintenance workers had refused to do it. In his street clothes, Kenny began cleaning the place, climbing into tanks and spraying a liquid chlorine mix. Chlorine is a hazardous chemical that can be inhaled or absorbed through the skin, causing a litany of health problems. Workers who spray it need to wear protective gloves, safety goggles, a self-contained respirator, and full coveralls. Kenny's supervisor gave him a paper dust mask to wear, but it quickly dissolved. After 8 hours of working with the chlorine in unventilated areas, Kenny went home and fell ill. He was rushed to the hospital and placed in an oxygen tent. His lungs had been burned by the chemicals. His body was covered in blisters. Kenny spent a month in the hospital. Kenny eventually recovered from the overexposure to chlorine, but it left his chest feeling raw, made him susceptible to colds and sensitive to chemical aromas. He went back to work at the Greeley plant. He had remarried, didn't know what other kind of work to do, still felt loyal to the company. He was assigned to an early morning shift. He had to drive an old truck from one part of the slaughterhouse complex to another. The truck was filled with leftover scraps of meat. The headlights and the wipers didn't work. The windshield was filthy and cracked. One cold, dark morning in the middle of winter, Kenny became disoriented while driving. He stopped the truck, opened the door, got out to see where he was, and was struck by a train. It knocked his glasses off, threw him up in the air, and knocked both of his work boots off. The train was moving slowly, or he would have been killed. Kenny somehow made it back to the plant, barefoot and bleeding from deep gashes in his back and his face. He spent 2 weeks at the hospital, then went back to work. One day, Kenny was in rendering and saw a worker about to stick his head into a pre-breaker break machine, a device that uses hundreds of small hammers to pulverize gristle and bone into a fine powder. The worker had just turned the machine off, but Kenny knew the hammers inside were still spinning. It takes 15 minutes for the machine to shut down completely. Kenny yelled, "Stop!" but the worker didn't hear him. And so Kenny ran across the room, grabbed the man by the seat of his pants, and pulled him away from the machine an instant before it would have pulverized him. To honor this act of bravery, Monfort gave Kenny an award for outstanding achievement and concern for fellow workers. The award was a paper certificate signed by his supervisor and the plant safety manager. Kenny later broke his leg stepping into a hole in the slaughterhouse's concrete floor. On another occasion, he shattered an ankle, an injury that required surgery and the insertion of 5 steel pins. Now Kenny had to wear a metal brace on one leg in order to walk, an elaborate spring-loaded brace that cost $2,000. Standing for long periods caused him great pain. He was given a job recycling old knives at the plant. Despite his many injuries, the job required him to climb up and down 3 flights of narrow stairs carrying garbage bags filled with knives. In December of 1995, Kenny felt a sharp pain in his chest while lifting some boxes. He thought it was a heart attack. His union steward took him to see the nurse, who said it was just a pulled muscle and sent Kenny home. He was indeed having a massive heart attack. A friend rushed Kenny to a nearby hospital. A stent was inserted in his heart, and the doctors told Kenny that he was lucky to be alive. Not long afterward, Monfort fired Kenny Dobbins. Despite the fact that Kenny had been with the company for almost 16 years, despite the fact that he was first in seniority at the Greeley plant, that he'd cleaned blood tanks with his bare hands, fought the union, done whatever the company had asked him to do, suffered injuries that would have killed weaker men, nobody from Monfort called him with the news. Nobody even bothered to write him. Kenny learned that he'd been fired when his payments to the company health insurance plan kept being returned by the post office. He called Monfort repeatedly to find out what was going on, and a sympathetic clerk in the claims office finally told Kenny that the checks were being returned because he was no longer a Monfort employee. When I asked company spokesmen to comment on the accuracy of Kenny's story, they would neither confirm nor deny any of the details. Today, Kenny is in poor health. His heart is permanently damaged. His immune system seems shot. His back hurts, his ankle hurts, and every so often he coughs up blood. He's unable to work at any job. His wife, Clara, who's half Latina and half Cheyenne, and looks like a younger sister of Cher's, was working as a nursing home attendant when Kenny had the heart attack. Amid the stress of his illness, she developed a serious kidney ailment. She's unemployed and recuperating from a kidney transplant. As I sat in the living room of their Greeley home, its walls decorated with paintings of wolves, Denver Broncos memorabilia, and an American flag, Kenny and Clara told me about their financial condition. After almost 16 years on the job, Kenny did not get any pension from Monfort. The company challenged his workers' comp claim and finally agreed, 3 years after the initial filing, to pay him a settlement of $35,000. 15% of that money went to Kenny's lawyer, and the rest is long gone. Some months, Kenny has to hawk things to get money for Clara's medicine. They have two teenage children and live on Social Security payments. Kenny's health insurance, which costs more than $600 a month, is about to run out. His anger at Munford, his feelings of betrayal, are of truly biblical proportions. "They used me to the point where I had no body parts left to give," Kenny said, struggling to maintain his composure. "Then they just tossed me into the trash can." Once strong and powerfully built, he now walks with difficulty, tires easily, and feels useless, as though his life were over. He's 45 years old. What's in the meat? On July 11, 1997, Lee Harding ordered soft chicken tacos at a Mexican restaurant in Pueblo, Colorado. Harding was 22 years old, a manager at Safeway. His wife Stacy was a manager at Wendy's. They were out to dinner on a Friday night. When the chicken tacos arrived, Harding thought there was something wrong with them. The meat seemed to have gone bad. The tacos tasted slimy and gross. An hour or so after leaving the restaurant, Harding began to experience severe abdominal cramps. It felt like something was eating away at his stomach. He was fit and healthy, stood 6'1", weighed 200 pounds. He'd never felt pain this intense. The cramps got worse, and Harding lay in bed through the night, tightly curled into a ball. He developed bad diarrhea, then bloody diarrhea. He felt like he was dying, but was afraid to go to the hospital. "If I'm going to die," he thought, "I want to die at home." The severe pain and diarrhea lasted through the weekend. On Monday evening, Harding decided to seek medical attention. The cramps were getting better, but he was still passing a good deal of blood. He waited 3 hours in the emergency room at St. Mary Corwin Hospital in Pueblo, gave a stool sample, and then finally saw a doctor. "It's probably just a summer flu," the doctor said. Harding was sent home with a prescription for an antibiotic. Tuesday afternoon, he heard a knock at his front door. When Harding opened it, nobody was there, but he found a note on the door from the Pueblo City County Health Department. It said that his stool sample had tested positive for Escherichia coli 0157H7, a virulent and potentially lethal foodborne pathogen. The next morning, Harding called Sandra Gallegos, a nurse with the Pueblo Health Department. She asked him to try and remember what foods he'd eaten during the previous 5 days. Harding mentioned the dinner at the Mexican restaurant and the foul taste of the chicken tacos. He was sure that was where he had gotten food poisoning. Gallegos disagreed. E. coli 0157H7 was rarely found in chicken. She asked if Harding had consumed any ground beef lately. Harding recalled having eaten a hamburger a couple of days before visiting the Mexican restaurant, but he doubted that the hamburger could have made him ill. Both his wife and his wife's sister had eaten the same burgers during a backyard barbecue, and neither had become sick. He and his wife had also eaten burgers from the same box the week before the barbecue without getting sick. They were frozen hamburgers he'd bought at Safeway. He remembered because it was the first time he'd ever bought frozen hamburgers. Gallegos asked if there were any left. Harding said there just might be, checked the freezer, and found the package. It was a red, white, and blue box that said Hudson Beef Patties. A Pueblo City County health official went to Harding's house, took the remaining hamburgers, and sent one to a USDA laboratory for analysis. State health officials had noticed a spike in the number of people suffering from E. coli 0157H7 infections. At the time, Colorado was one of only 6 states with the capability to perform DNA tests on samples of E. coli 0157H7. The DNA tests showed that at least 10 people had been sickened by the same strain of the bug. Investigators were searching for a common link between scattered cases reported in Pueblo, Brighton, Loveland, Grand Junction, and Colorado Springs. On July 28th, the USDA lab notified Gallegos that Lee Harding's hamburger was contaminated with the same strain of E. coli 0157H7. Here was the common link. The lot number on Harding's package said that the frozen patties had been manufactured on June 5th at the Hudson Foods plant in Columbus, Nebraska. The plant seemed an unlikely source for an outbreak of food poisoning. Only 2 years old, it had been built primarily to supply hamburgers for the Burger King chain. It used state-of-the-art equipment and appeared to be spotlessly clean. But something had gone wrong. A modern factory designed for the mass production of food had instead become a vector for the spread of a deadly disease. The package of hamburger patties in Lee Harding's freezer and astute investigative work by Colorado health officials soon led to the largest recall of food in the nation's history. Roughly 35 million pounds of ground beef produced at the Columbus plant, enough meat to provide every single American with a tainted fast food hamburger, was voluntarily recalled by Hudson Foods in August of 1997. Although public health officials did a fine job of tracing the outbreak to its source, the recall proved less successful. By the time it was announced, about 25 million pounds of the ground beef had already been eaten. Every day in the United States, roughly 200,000 people are sickened by a foodborne disease, 900 are hospitalized, and 14 die. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, more than a quarter of the American population suffers a bout of food poisoning each year. Most of these cases are never reported to authorities or properly diagnosed. The widespread outbreaks that are detected and identified represent a small fraction of the number that actually occurs. And there is strong evidence not only that the incidence of food-related illness has risen in the past few decades, but also that the lasting health consequences of such illnesses are far more serious than was previously believed. The acute phase of a food poisoning, the initial few days of diarrhea and gastrointestinal upset, in many cases, may simply be the most obvious manifestation of an infectious disease. Recent studies have found that many foodborne pathogens can precipitate long-term ailments, such as heart disease, inflammatory bowel disease, neurological problems, autoimmune disorders, and kidney damage. Although the rise in foodborne illnesses has been caused by many complex factors, much of the increase can be attributed to recent changes in how American food is produced. Robert V. Tux, head of the Foodborne and Diarrheal Diseases Branch at the CDC, believes that entirely new kinds of outbreaks are now occurring. A generation ago, the typical outbreak of food poisoning involved a church supper, a family picnic, a wedding reception. Improper food handling or storage would cause a small group of people in one local area to get sick. Such traditional outbreaks still take place, but the nation's industrialized and centralized system of food processing has created a whole new sort of outbreak, one that can potentially sicken millions of people. Today, a cluster of illnesses in one small town may stem from bad potato salad at a school barbecue, or it may be the first sign of an outbreak that extends statewide, nationwide, or even overseas. Much like the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, responsible for causing AIDS, the E. coli 0157H7 bacterium is a newly emerged pathogen whose spread has been facilitated by recent social and technological changes. E. coli 0157H7 was first isolated in 1982. HIV was discovered the following year. People who are infected with HIV can appear healthy for years, while cattle infected with E. coli 0157H7 show few signs of illness. Although cases of AIDS date back at least to the late 1950s, the disease did not reach epidemic proportions in the United States until increased air travel and sexual promiscuity helped transmit the virus far and wide. E. coli 0157H7 was most likely responsible for some human illnesses 30 or 40 years ago. But the rise of huge feedlots, slaughterhouses, and hamburger grinders seems to have provided the means for this pathogen to become widely dispersed in the nation's food supply. American meat production has never before been so centralized. 13 large packing houses now slaughter most of the beef consumed in the United States. The meat packing system that arose to supply the nation's fast food chains, an industry molded to serve their needs to provide massive amounts of uniform ground beef so that all of McDonald's hamburgers would taste the same, has proved to be an extremely efficient system for spreading disease. Although E. coli 0157H7 has received a good deal of public attention, over the past two decades, scientists have discovered more than a dozen other new foodborne pathogens, including Campylobacter jejuni, Cryptosporidium perium, Cyclospora caetanensis, Listeria monocytogenes, and Norwalk-like viruses. The CDC estimates that more than three-quarters of the food-related illnesses and deaths in the United States are caused by infectious agents that have not yet been identified. While medical researchers have gained important insights into the links between modern food processing and the spread of dangerous diseases, the nation's leading agribusiness firms have resolutely opposed any further regulation of their food safety practices. For years, the large meatpacking companies have managed to avoid the sort of liability routinely imposed on the manufacturers of most consumer products. Today, the U.S. government can demand the nationwide recall of defective softball bats, sneakers, stuffed animals, and foam rubber toy cows. But it cannot order a meatpacking company to remove contaminated, potentially lethal ground beef from fast food kitchens and supermarket shelves. The unusual power of the large meatpacking firms has been sustained by their close ties and sizable donations to Republican members of Congress. It's also been made possible by a widespread lack of awareness about how many Americans suffer from food poisoning every year and how these illnesses actually spread. The newly recognized foodborne pathogens tend to be carried and shed by apparently healthy animals. Food tainted by these organisms has most likely come in contact with an infected animal's stomach contents or manure during slaughter or subsequent processing. A nationwide study published by the USDA in 1996 found that 7.5% of the ground beef samples taken at processing plants were contaminated with salmonella. 11.7% were contaminated with Listeria monocytogenes. 30% were contaminated with Staphylococcus aureus, and 53.3% were contaminated with Clostridium perfringens. All of these pathogens can make people sick. Food poisoning caused by Listeria generally requires hospitalization and proves fatal in about 1 out of every 5 cases. In the USDA study, 78.6% of the ground beef contained microbes that are spread primarily by fecal material. The medical literature on the causes of food poisoning is full of euphemisms and dry scientific terms: coliform levels, aerobic plate counts, sorbitol, McConkie agar, and so on. Behind them lies a simple explanation for why eating a hamburger can now make you seriously ill. There is shit in the meat. In the early years of the 20th century, hamburgers had a bad reputation. According to the historian David Gerard Hogan, the hamburger was considered a food for the poor, tainted, and unsafe to eat. Restaurants rarely served hamburgers. They were sold at lunch carts parked near factories, at circuses, carnivals, and state fairs. Ground beef, it was widely believed, was made from old putrid meat heavily laced with chemical preservatives. The hamburger habit is just about as safe, one food critic warned, as getting your meat out of a garbage can. White Castle, the nation's first hamburger chain, worked hard in the 1920s to dispel the hamburger's tawdry image. As Hogan notes in his History of the Chain, Selling 'em by the Sack, 1997, The founders of White Castle placed their grills in direct view of customers, claimed that fresh ground beef was delivered twice a day, chose a name with connotations of purity, and even sponsored an experiment at the University of Minnesota in which a medical student lived for 13 weeks on nothing but White Castle hamburgers and water. The success of White Castle in the East and the Midwest helped to popularize hamburgers and to remove much of their social stigma. The chain did not attract a broad range of people, however. Most of White Castle's customers were urban, working class, and male. During the 1950s, the rise of drive-ins and fast food restaurants in Southern California helped turn the once lowly hamburger into America's national dish. Ray Kroc's decision to promote McDonald's as a restaurant chain for families had a profound impact on the nation's eating habits. Hamburgers seemed an ideal food for small children, convenient, inexpensive, handheld, and easy to chew. Before World War II, pork had been the most popular meat in the United States. Rising incomes, falling cattle prices, the growth of the fast food industry, and the mass appeal of the hamburger later pushed American consumption of beef higher than that of pork. By the early 1990s, beef production was responsible for almost half of the employment in American agriculture, and the annual revenues generated by beef were higher than those of any other agricultural commodity in the United States. The average American ate 3 hamburgers a week. More than 2/3 of those hamburgers were bought at fast food restaurants. And children between the ages of 7 and 13 ate more hamburgers than anyone else. In January of 1993, doctors at a hospital in Seattle, Washington, noticed that an unusual number of children were being admitted with bloody diarrhea. Some were suffering from hemolytic uremic syndrome, a previously rare disorder that causes kidney damage. Health officials soon traced the outbreak of food poisoning to undercooked hamburgers served at local Jack-in-the-Box restaurants. Tests of the hamburger patties disclosed the presence of E. coli 0157H7. Jack-in-the-Box issued an immediate recall of the contaminated ground beef, which had been supplied by the Vons Companies Incorporated in Arcadia, California. Nevertheless, more than 700 people in at least 4 states were sickened by Jack-in-the-Box hamburgers. More than 200 people were hospitalized, and 4 died. Most of the victims were children. One of the first to become ill, Lauren Beth Rudolph, ate a hamburger at a San Diego Jack-in-the-Box a week before Christmas. She was admitted to the hospital on Christmas Eve, suffered terrible pain, had 3 heart attacks, and died in her mother's arms on December 28, 1992. She was 6 years old. The Jack-in-the-Box outbreak received a great deal of attention from the media, alerting the public to the dangers of E. coli 0157H7. The Jack-in-the-Box chain almost went out of business amid all the bad publicity. But this was not the first outbreak of E. coli 0157H7 linked to fast food hamburgers. In 1982, dozens of children were sickened by contaminated hamburgers sold at McDonald's restaurants in Oregon and Michigan. McDonald's quietly cooperated with investigators from the CDC, providing ground beef samples that were tainted with E. coli 0157H7, samples that for the first time linked the pathogen to serious illnesses. In public, however, the McDonald's Corporation denied that its hamburgers had made anyone sick. A spokesman for the chain acknowledged only the possibility of a statistical association between a small number of diarrhea cases in 2 small towns and our restaurants. In the 8 years since the Jack-in-the-Box outbreak, approximately 500,000 Americans, the majority of them children, have been made ill by E. coli 0157H7. Thousands have been hospitalized, and hundreds have died. E. coli 0157H7 is a mutated version of a bacterium found abundantly in the human digestive system. Most E. coli bacteria help us digest food, synthesize vitamins, and guard against dangerous organisms. E. coli 0157H7, on the other hand, can release a powerful toxin called a virotoxin or a Shiga toxin that attacks the lining of the intestine. Some people who are infected with E. coli 0157H7 do not become ill. Others suffer mild diarrhea. In most cases, severe abdominal cramps are followed by watery, then bloody diarrhea that subsides within a week or so. Sometimes the diarrhea is accompanied by vomiting and a low-grade fever. In about 4% of reported E. coli 0157H7 cases, the Shiga toxins enter the bloodstream, causing hemolytic uremic syndrome, HUS, which can lead to kidney failure, anemia, internal bleeding, and the destruction of vital organs. The Shiga toxins can cause seizures, neurological damage, and strokes. About 5% of the children who develop HUS are killed by it. Those who survive are often left with permanent disabilities, such as blindness or brain damage. Children under the age of 5, the elderly, and people with impaired immune systems are the most likely to suffer from illnesses caused by E. coli 0157H7. The pathogen is now the leading cause of kidney failure among children in the United States. Nancy Donnelly, the president of Safe Tables Our Priority, STOP, an organization devoted to food safety, says it's hard to convey the suffering that E. coli 0157H7 causes children. Her 6-year-old son, Alex, was infected with the bug in July of 1993 after eating a tainted hamburger. His illness began with abdominal cramps that seemed as severe as labor pains. It progressed to diarrhea that filled a hospital toilet with blood. Doctors frantically tried to save Alex's life, drilling holes in his skull to relieve pressure, inserting tubes in his chest to keep him breathing, as the Shiga toxins destroyed internal organs. "I would have done anything to save my son's life," Donnelly says. "I would have run in front of a bus to save Alex." Instead, she stood and watched helplessly as he called out for her, terrified and in pain. He became ill on a Tuesday night, the night after his mother's birthday, and was dead by Sunday afternoon. Toward the end, Alex suffered hallucinations and dementia, no longer recognizing his mother or father. Portions of his brain had been liquefied. The sheer brutality of his death was horrifying, Donnelly says. As Lee Harding learned, adults in perfect health can be stricken by the pathogen too. 6 months after seemingly recovering from his bout of E. coli 0157H7 food poisoning, Harding began to urinate blood. He was diagnosed as having a kidney infection, one that he believes was facilitated by residual tissue damage from the Shiga toxins. Although the infection soon passed, Harding still experiences occasional pain 3 years after eating a Hudson beef hamburger. Nevertheless, he considers himself lucky. Antibiotics have proven ineffective in treating illnesses caused by E. coli 0157H7. Indeed, the use of antibiotics may make such illnesses worse by killing off the pathogen and prompting a sudden release of its Shiga toxins. At the moment, little can be done for people with life-threatening E. coli 0157H7 infections, aside from giving them fluids, blood transfusions, and dialysis. Efforts to eradicate E. coli 0157H7 have been complicated by the fact that it's an extraordinarily hardy microbe that's easy to transmit. E. coli 0157H7 is resistant to acid, salt, and chlorine. It can live in freshwater or seawater. It can live on kitchen countertops for days and in moist environments for weeks. It can withstand freezing. It can survive heat up to 160 degrees Fahrenheit. To be infected by most foodborne pathogens, salmonella, you have to consume a fairly large dose, at least a million organisms. An infection with E. coli 0157H7 can be caused by as few as 5 organisms. A tiny, uncooked particle of hamburger meat can contain enough of the pathogen to kill you. The hardiness and minute infectious dose of E. coli 0157H7 allow the pathogen to be spread in many ways. People have been infected by drinking contaminated water, by swimming in a contaminated lake, by playing at a contaminated water park, by crawling on a contaminated carpet. The most common cause of foodborne outbreaks has been the consumption of undercooked ground beef. But E. coli 0157H7 outbreaks have also been caused by contaminated bean sprouts, salad greens, cantaloupe, salami, raw milk, and unpasteurized apple cider. All of those foods most likely had come in contact with cattle manure, though the pathogen may also be spread by the feces of deer, dogs, horses, and flies. Person-to-person transmission has been responsible for a significant proportion of E. coli 0157H7 illnesses. Roughly 10% of the people sickened during the Jack in the Box outbreak did not eat a contaminated burger, but were infected by someone who did. E. coli 0157H7 is shed in the stool, and people infected with the bug, even those showing no outward sign of illness, can easily spread it through poor hygiene. Person-to-person transmission is most likely to occur among family members, at daycare centers, and at senior citizen homes. On average, an infected person remains contagious for about 2 weeks, though in some cases, E. coli 0157H7 has been found in stool samples 2 to 4 months after an initial illness. Some herds of American cattle may have been infected with E. coli 0157H7 decades ago, but the recent changes in how cattle are raised, slaughtered, and processed have created an ideal means for the pathogen to spread. The problem begins in today's vast feedlots. A government health official, who prefers not to be named, compared the sanitary conditions in a modern feedlot to those in a crowded European city during the Middle Ages, when people dumped their chamber pots out the window, raw sewage ran in the streets, and epidemics raged. The cattle now packed into feedlots get little exercise and live amid pools of manure. "You shouldn't eat dirty food and dirty water," the official told me, "but we still think we can give animals dirty food and dirty water." Feedlots have become an extremely efficient mechanism for recirculating the manure, which is unfortunate, since E. coli 0157H7 can replicate in cattle troughs and survive in manure for up to 90 days. Far from their natural habitat, the cattle in feedlots become more prone to all sorts of illnesses. And what they're being fed often contributes to the spread of disease. The rise in grain prices has encouraged the feeding of less expensive materials to cattle, especially substances with a high protein content that accelerate growth. About 75% of the cattle in the United States were routinely fed livestock wastes, the rendered remains of dead sheep and dead cattle, until August of 1997. They were also fed millions of dead cats and dead dogs every year, purchased from animal shelters. The FDA banned such practices after evidence from Great Britain suggested that they were responsible for a widespread outbreak of bovine spongiform encephalopathy, BSE, also known as mad cow disease. Nevertheless, current FDA regulations allow dead pigs and dead horses to be rendered into cattle feed, along with dead poultry. The regulations not only allow cattle to be fed dead poultry, they allow poultry to be fed dead cattle. Americans who spent more than 6 months in the United Kingdom during the 1980s are now forbidden to donate blood in order to prevent the spread of BSE's human variant, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. But cattle blood is still put into the feed given to American cattle. Stephen P. Bjerkley, a former editor of the trade journal Meat and Poultry, is appalled by what goes into cattle feed these days. "God damn it, these cattle are ruminants," Bjerkley says. "They're designed to eat grass and maybe grain. I mean, they have four stomachs for a reason. to eat products that have a high cellulose content. They are not designed to eat other animals. The waste products from poultry plants, including the sawdust and old newspapers used as litter, are also being fed to cattle. A study published a few years ago in Preventive Medicine notes that in Arkansas alone, about 3 million pounds of chicken manure were fed to cattle in 1994. According to Dr. Neil D. Bernard, who heads the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, chicken manure may contain dangerous bacteria such as Salmonella and Campylobacter, parasites such as tapeworms and Giardia lamblia, antibiotic residues, arsenic, and heavy metals. The pathogens from infected cattle are spread not only in feedlots, but also at slaughterhouses and hamburger grinders. The slaughterhouse tasks most likely to contaminate meat are the removal of an animal's hide and the removal of its digestive system. The hides are now pulled off by machine. If a hide has been inadequately cleaned, chunks of dirt and manure may fall from it onto the meat. Stomachs and intestines are still pulled out of cattle by hand. If the job is not performed carefully, the contents of the digestive system may spill everywhere. The increased speed of today's production lines makes the task much more difficult. A single worker at a gut table may eviscerate 60 cattle an hour. Performing the job properly takes a fair amount of skill. A former IBP gutter told me that it took him 6 months to learn how to pull out the stomach and tie off the intestines without spillage. At best, he could gut 200 consecutive cattle without spilling anything. Inexperienced gutters spill manure far more often. At the IBP slaughterhouse in Lexington, Nebraska, the hourly spillage rate at the gut table has run as high as 20%, with stomach contents splattering one out of five carcasses. The consequences of a single error are quickly multiplied as hundreds of carcasses quickly move down the line. Knives are supposed to be cleaned and disinfected every few minutes, something that workers in a hurry tend to forget. A contaminated knife spreads germs to everything it touches. The overworked, often illiterate workers in the nation's slaughterhouses do not always understand the importance of good hygiene. They sometimes forget that this meat will eventually be eaten. They drop meat on the floor and then place it right back on the conveyor belt. They cook bite-sized pieces of meat in their sterilizers as snacks, thereby rendering the sterilizers ineffective. They are directly exposed to a wide variety of pathogens in the meat, become infected, and inadvertently spread disease. A recent USDA study found that during the winter, about 1% of the cattle at feedlots carry E. coli 0157H7 in their gut. The proportion rises to as much as 50% during the summer. Even if you assume that only 1% are infected, that means 3 or 4 cattle bearing the microbe are eviscerated at a large slaughterhouse every hour. The odds of widespread contamination are raised exponentially when the meat is processed into ground beef. A generation ago, local butchers and wholesalers made hamburger meat out of leftover scraps. Ground beef was distributed locally and was often made from cattle slaughtered locally. Today, large slaughterhouses and grinders dominate the nationwide production of ground beef. A modern processing plant can produce 800,000 pounds of hamburger a day, meat that will be shipped throughout the United States. A single animal infected with E. coli 0157H7 can contaminate 32,000 pounds of that ground beef. To make matters worse, the animals used to make about one quarter of the nation's ground beef, worn-out dairy cattle, are the animals most likely to be diseased and riddled with antibiotic residues. The stresses of industrial milk production make them even more unhealthy than cattle in a large feedlot. Dairy cattle can live as long as 40 years, but are often slaughtered at the age of 4, when their milk output starts to decline. McDonald's relies heavily on dairy cattle for its hamburger supplies. Since the animals are relatively inexpensive, yield low-fat meat, and enable the chain to boast that all its beef is raised in the United States. The days when hamburger meat was ground in the back of a butcher shop out of scraps from one or two sides of beef are long gone. Like the multiple sex partners that helped spread the AIDS epidemic, the huge admixture of animals in most American ground beef plants has played a crucial role in spreading E. coli 0157H7. A single fast food hamburger now contains meat from dozens or even hundreds of different cattle. "This is no fairy story and no joke," Upton Sinclair wrote in 1906. "The meat would be shoveled into carts, and the man who did the shoveling would not trouble to lift out a rat even when he saw one. There were things that went into the sausage in comparison with which a poisoned rat was a tidbit." Sinclair described a long list of practices in the meatpacking industry that threatened the health of consumers: the routine slaughter of diseased animals, the use of chemicals such as borax and glycerin to disguise the smell of spoiled beef, the deliberate mislabeling of canned meat, the tendency of workers to urinate and defecate on the kill floor. After reading The Jungle, President Theodore Roosevelt ordered an independent investigation of Sinclair's charges. When it confirmed the accuracy of the book, Roosevelt called for legislation requiring mandatory federal inspection of all meat sold through interstate commerce, accurate labeling and dating of canned meat products, and a fee-based regulatory system that made meat packers pay the cost of cleaning up their own industry. The powerful magnates of the Beef Trust responded by vilifying Roosevelt and Upton Sinclair, dismissing their accusations, and launching a public relations campaign to persuade the American people that nothing was wrong. "Meat and food products, generally speaking," J. Ogden Armour claimed in a Saturday Evening Post article, "are handled as carefully and circumspectly in large packing houses as they are in the average home kitchen." Testifying before Congress, Thomas Wilson, an executive at Morris & Company, said that blame for the occasional sanitary lapse lay not with the policies of industry executives, but with the greed and laziness of slaughterhouse workers. "Men are men," Wilson contended, "and it's pretty hard to control some of them." After an angry legislative battle, Congress narrowly passed the Meat Inspection Act of 1906, a watered-down version of Roosevelt's proposals that made taxpayers pay for the new regulations. The meatpacking industry's response to the jungle established a pattern that would be repeated throughout the 20th century, whenever health concerns were raised about the nation's beef. The industry has repeatedly denied that problems exist, impugned the motives of its critics, fought vehemently against federal oversight, sought to avoid any responsibility for outbreaks of food poisoning, and worked hard to shift the costs of food safety efforts onto the general public. The industry's strategy has been driven by a profound antipathy to any government regulation that might lower profits. "There is no limit to the expense that might be put upon us," the Beef Trust's Wilson said in 1906, arguing against a federal inspection plan that would have cost meat packers less than a dime per head of cattle. "Our contention is that in all reasonableness and fairness, we are paying all we care to pay." During the 1980s, as the risks of widespread contamination increased, the meatpacking industry blocked the use of microbial testing in the federal meat inspection program. A panel appointed by the National Academy of Sciences warned in 1985 that the nation's meat inspection program was hopelessly outdated, still relying on visual and olfactory clues to find disease, while dangerous pathogens slipped past undetected. 3 years later, another National Academy of Sciences panel warned that the nation's public health infrastructure was in serious disarray, limiting its ability to track or prevent the spread of newly emerging pathogens. Without additional funding for public health measures, outbreaks and epidemics of new diseases were virtually inevitable. "Who knows what crisis will be next?" said the chairman of the panel. Nevertheless, the Reagan and Bush administrations cut spending on public health measures and staffed the U.S. Department of Agriculture with officials far more interested in government deregulation than in food safety.